It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Little Free Libraries started in Hudson, Wisconsin in 2009. A decade later, there are more than 80,000 of these book exchanges and book stewards scattered across more than 90 countries around the world. In this edition of Wisconsin Weekend, we talk about how Little Free Libraries became a global movement and how you can make a Little Free Library of your own. Do you stop at these Little Free Libraries? Maybe you're intrigued, but you've never opened the door to check out what's inside. What kinds of books have you left at a Little Free Library for other people to enjoy? And what's your favorite find at one of these? 800-642-1234. Tell us your story. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Margaret Aldrich is the Media and Programming Manager for Little Free Library. She's the author of the Little Free Library book. Margaret, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
For those listeners who may not know, what is a Little Free Library and how does it work?
A Little Free Library is a community book exchange. So a Little Free Library is a box full of books. And when you're out in your community and you see one, you can open that door, look inside, and if you see a book you like, you can take it home. Or if you have a book, you can share it for someone else to find.
So if you decide you want a Little Free Library in your neighborhood, do you have to build your own little structure to hold the books?
There's a couple different ways you can do it. You can certainly build your own and you can get as creative as you want. I've seen Little Free Libraries that look like rocket ships or castles. People get really creative. And then you can register it with the Little Free Library nonprofit at littlefreelibrary.org. Or you can, if you aren't handy like me, you can buy a Little Free Library from us at littlefreelibrary.org, or you can buy a kit and put it together.
The first Little Free Library was created 10 years ago in Hudson, Wisconsin. Tell us about Todd Bowl and what inspired him to create a tiny library in his neighborhood.
So Todd was a very entrepreneurial, creative spirit, and his mother had passed away, and Todd wanted to honor her in some way. She was an educator. She was a lifelong reader, and he was looking at all of her books and thought he wanted to share those with his neighbors. So he built this little box, and it was shaped like a one-room schoolhouse, even with a little bell on top, and he put it out in his front yard. And when he saw how his neighbors reacted to it, how they would gather around and have conversations and share books, he thought he had something and wanted to share it with the rest of the world.
So how did this grow from this one Little Free Library in Hudson, Wisconsin, to something that's now worldwide? How did that come about?
Well, Todd and a man named Rick Brooks created the nonprofit organization Little Free Library. They started, testing out Little Free Libraries in different communities. So Madison, Wisconsin was one of the first communities to have Little Free Libraries, and also Minneapolis, Minnesota. And little by little, first it was word of mouth they started to spread. Then it was really social media that helped spread the Little Free Library movement. And that's really where Little Free Libraries started showing up in other states and eventually other countries, everywhere from Australia to Italy to Pakistan to Brazil.
Margaret Aldrich is a spokesperson for Little Free Library. Share your Little Free Library story with us at 800-642-1234. Have you used one of these book exchanges? And what book did you find and what book did you leave? 800-642-1234. So how many Little Free Libraries are there in the world, and how many countries are they in?
There are more than 80,000 registered Little Free Libraries, and we've now reached 91 countries. So that's amazing to see how this concept of sharing books and building community is really universal.
What's the most unusual place we could find a Little Free Library?
Oh, that's a good question. We haven't gotten to Antarctica yet, but we're on all the other continents. But we did hear about near the Siberian Arctic Circle, there is a group of reindeer herders that are establishing little free libraries.
Oh, that is really cool. So where are what places have the most little free libraries?
Well, Wisconsin and Minnesota have the most per capita. So we're proud of that. Wisconsin is the birthplace of the first little free library, so I think that's really appropriate. Also, the state of California has more little free libraries than any other state, but they're bigger than we are. As far as other countries, Italy has a lot of little free libraries. The Netherlands, Australia, and Brazil are really big for little free libraries.
Okay, so we mentioned earlier that if someone wants to have a little free library in their community, they need to, get in touch with your organization, and you can give them the information they need. Are there criteria that have to be met for someone to have an official little free library?
Well, we try to have as few rules as possible about what your little free library is going to look like, because we love that a little free library can reflect your personality and your neighborhood. We do love it when people register with us so you can be added to the world map. Our world map is, one of our most visited pages on our website, and it's a great way for people to find little free libraries when they're traveling or when they want to go for a bike ride with their family. They can have a little free library tour.
And does it cost anything to register a little free library?
Yeah, there's a one-time fee that's about $40. And when you register with us, we will send you a charter sign to put on your little free library, as well as a guidebook for being a new steward.
And now I'm anybody who knows me knows that I am absolutely useless with carpentry tools. Can I buy one of these little free library boxes online, or do I have to build it myself?
You certainly can build one that's, or can buy one that's already finished. And I know that when I was putting up a little free library, I wanted to participate in the building a little bit, so I bought a kit. So that way you get to hold a power tool, but you don't need to know too much.
Well, yeah, I don't mind holding power tools. I just should probably not be allowed to use them. I would. You mentioned a couple of different kinds of little free libraries. Someone made one that looked like a spaceship. What are some of the other really clever renditions of the little free library that you've seen or heard about?
Oh, recently there was a woman in Idaho who, in her front yard, she had this 100-year-old cottonwood tree, and it was starting to be on its last legs. The city said, "We're going to have to take this down." And she, instead of cutting it all the way down, she left a large stump, and she turned it into this really magical, huge little free library that you can actually walk inside. It has lights on the interior and the exterior, and it really looks like a magical elf lives inside this giant little free library.
Oh, that is so cool. Speaking of cool, it would be really cool if people called in and told us their little free library stories. There are a lot of these little free library book exchanges in Wisconsin. So do you stop at them? Maybe you've been intrigued, but you've never opened the door to check what's inside. Or maybe you're a frequent user. What books have you left behind? And what kinds of books have you found? What are your favorite little free library finds? And maybe you came across a book that seemed okay but turned out to be incredible. Maybe you found a childhood favorite. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Margaret Aldrich stays with us. She's the media and programming manager for Little Free Library and the author of the Little Free Library book. 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. In this week's edition of Wisconsin Weekend, we're celebrating a decade of little free libraries. Started in Hudson, Wisconsin in 2009, these book exchanges are now all over the world. Have you built a little free library? What does yours look like? Do people pick up books, or do you see them sitting there for a long time without anyone stopping by? What's your favorite little free library in your community? Do you walk or drive by it every day? And what do you love about it? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is our email address, and you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Margaret Aldrich is a spokesperson for the Little Free Library. Margaret, what stories have you heard from people about a book they found in a Little Free Library that was a real game changer for them?
Oh, that's an interesting question. We've certainly heard from people who, you know, found a book that they loved as a kid and then shared it with their own child. And that's been something really special. We've had people meet people while at a Little Free Library. One person was visiting a Little Free Library and discovered that that was her former teacher from when she was a kid, and they struck up a conversation. But I know that I have found books that I felt like the universe was telling me I needed to read. I had always been a little ashamed. I'd never read Ulysses, even though I was an English major back in college. And one day Ulysses showed up in my Little Free Library, and I took it as a serendipitous sign from the book universe.
Well, I'm sure that a lot of other people have stories like that, and I hope they'll share them with us this morning at 800-642-1234. Margaret, do you have a sense of whether Little Free Libraries are distributed evenly throughout communities, regardless of the socioeconomic status of a given neighborhood?
Yeah, that's a great question to be thinking about. You know, we definitely see Little Free Libraries in all different kinds of communities. You know, Detroit, for example, has a Little Free Library at all 97 of their public schools. In the Philippines, they have Little Free Libraries in some of their impoverished areas. But, you know, in a lot of communities in the U.S., the first Little Free Library in a community will pop up in a middle class or an upper middle class neighborhood. And from there, it'll start to spread out into other kinds of communities. So we are always working to get Little Free Libraries into more high needs neighborhoods. And something that we use to do that is our Impact Library program. So with that program, people can apply to receive a Little Free Library at no cost, and we'll send them a Little Free Library, books, the post, everything they need. So they can bring a Little Free Library to a community where it can make a really meaningful impact, both on book access and on community building.
You know, that's if somebody then has books they would like to donate but doesn't want to have to actually put up a Little Free Library themselves, is there a way they can do that?
Yeah, I would, you know, look at your community and look at our Little Free Library map, and I would have a fun day of dropping off books at Little Free Libraries right where you live.
Okay, well, that's a great idea, I think, and a lot of us have a lot of books and maybe more books than we need, and maybe this would be a way for us to put them to good use. We have some people who are starting to line up to tell their stories. Let's hear from Chris in Waukesha first. Chris, thanks for joining us on the morning show.
Thank you for having me. So I was an executive director of a homeless shelter in our community, and we had volunteers who built a Little Free Library for us, which was a wonderful way for community members to get involved. They installed it right outside of the shelter that we had for families. And then the community had the opportunity to continually provide new books for the children in our community who were experiencing homelessness. A lot of times those families weren't able to bring a lot of things with them. And so the opportunity for the kids to have books that they could pick out and take with them and have always kind of new things to be learning and reading was a wonderful opportunity for our guests, but also for community members to invest in our young people.
Chris, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Margaret, that sounds like a wonderful application of the Impact Library program.
That's amazing. I love to hear that story. And I know recently some of our Impact Library recipients did include another homeless shelter. I think that one was in California. You know, high need schools often receive them. We work with Native American reservations. So there are some really amazing places that can, you know, benefit from more books.
Chris, thanks so much for that call. You could share your story with us at 800-642-1234. George is with us in Fitchburg. George, good morning.
Yes, good morning. I have an idea for an addition to the little free library, and that would be to put in these little, it's a combination book and a CD or a cassette. They've had them for many years. My daughter used it as a child, and now she's using it with her children. But you could also use CDs. They could have a section in the little free library that is for the real young ones to have CDs that they could leave and exchange, or these little cassettes that come with the books that the children read and follow with the cassette in order to learn how to read.
George, thanks for that. So what do you think, Margaret? Could audiobooks on CDs in little free libraries, are those allowed?
Absolutely. I love that idea. You know, we see people getting really innovative about what they share in their little free libraries. So this time of year, we see people even sharing garden seeds. So you plant your garden, you don't need all of your seeds. Maybe start a seed exchange in your little free library.
Oh, what a great idea. George, thanks so much for your call. Let's go next to Linda in Edgerton. Linda, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Thank you.
Go ahead and tell us your story.
Well, I live in Edgerton, and my husband and I have always been very interested in promoting getting kids learning to read. And my husband built two little free libraries here in Edgerton, one at our house and one in front of a local coffee shop. And my favorite little free library story is one day my husband and I were sitting outside in the summer, and our little free library is right in the corner of our yard. And some young boys, maybe 10, 11, 12 years old, were riding by on their bicycles. And one looked back to their other one and pointed to the little free library and said, "We have to stop here. This is where I got that really cool book."
What a great story, Margaret. Linda, thanks so much for sharing that. Margaret, I'm sure you hear lots of those kinds of stories.
I do, and I never get tired of hearing those. I mean, there really is something magic about this little box of books, and I love that they can help get kids excited about reading.
What is Little Free Library doing to celebrate its 10th anniversary?
Oh, we are so excited to celebrate the 10th anniversary. We recently gave out the first ever Todd H. Bull Awards for Outstanding Achievement, really honoring stewards around the country and around the world doing great things in their communities. And we're also hosting something starting today through the weekend called The Big Share. And we want everybody to participate in this. During The Big Share, we want you to share a book in a little free library, snap a photo of your visit, and then share that photo with us on our website or on social media with the hashtag LFL10. And we're really trying to build, a shared love of reading around the world and a shared sense of community.
And there are, you mentioned the Todd H. Bull Awards. There were some winners from Wisconsin, right?
Absolutely. There were two winners from Wisconsin out of the 10 winners. So one was a boy named Evan Peterson in Spring Valley, Wisconsin. And Evan started his little free library when he was in the fourth grade. He has experienced health issues throughout his life, and this little free library was a great way for him to stay connected to his community, even when he couldn't go to school. So Evan is now in eighth grade, and he is still a wonderful little free library ambassador. So we honored Evan. We also honored a man named Chuck Brihoda. He's of Medford, Wisconsin. And Chuck creates these whimsical little free libraries that he builds. And they look like school buses. They look like train stations. They look like a big treasure chest. So we honored Chuck for really sparking that creativity. And, you know, he does this because he wants kids to have a positive view of reading and to be excited about picking up a book.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. Tell us again where we can find out more about Little Free Libraries.
Please visit us at littlefreelibrary.org.
littlefreelibrary.org. Thank you so much for joining us, Margaret.
Thank you.
Margaret Aldrich is the Media and Programming Manager for Little Free Library. She is the author of the Little Free Library book. It's Wisconsin Weekend here on The Morning Show. Coming up next, we profile bartenders at a longtime Wisconsin hangout. That's up after the news. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. This is the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum.
In a city with never-ending bar options, Dell's Bar in downtown La Crosse sticks out. It's been open since 1933, and on any given day, you'll find 40-year regulars, college students, and tourists chatting with each other around an oval-shaped bar. One Sunday afternoon, with the Brewers game and jukebox blaring, two bartenders tell me what Dell's is famous for: Oktoberfest, camaraderie, and Bloody Marys.
One thing about the Bloodies is that I enjoy making Bloodies. I also enjoy Bloody statistics.
Break it down.
The one year, though, was 12,736 Bloody Marys.
I love how you know these numbers.
Sarah Viner. I've worked here for 20 years. I started working because I was working construction, and we started to get laid off, and I found bartending on the off season. I started bartending, and I liked it. I liked the socialness aspect of it.
Thank you. What can I get you, ladies?
Can I just have a regular Bloody Mary, please?
You too.
I love Dell's because, for one, it's kind of like a small community where it's got a lot of character, and everyone here is a family. My name is Bree Ruppel. I worked at Dell's Bar for about 7 years, on and off. A lot of people who aren't in the industry think that it's always about the drinks. And really, when I come into it, I'm thinking, like, how can I craft this experience for the customer to be the best experience they've had? Because they come here, yeah, they come here to drink after work, but you know, they want to have a good time, they want good stories, they want good music, and otherwise they can just drink at home. Oh, I love this song. I want to play this.
That's one thing I love about being here, and the music, and how good it feels when we bartend together and make the freaking customers just get into it and just, you know, dance, sing.
I think one of the most insulting things that anyone has said to me as a bartender is, well, so what's your real job? How is this not a real job?
It is a real job.
I'm getting paid great money. I love what I do. I don't wake up dreading to go to work.
Nope. Never have. You may get the bar occasional burnout, but everybody does. That's normal.
I love working Oktoberfest. Oktoberfest is crazy anywhere you go in La Crosse that whole weekend.
It's fun, it's fast, it's loud.
The thing is that we have such a tight-knit crew here. I always likened it to going to battle. You know, we're downstairs, like, eating food beforehand. People are listening to music to, like, amp themselves up for the shift, getting ready, and then it's kind of like you're thrown into it. It's nonstop. And then by the end, when we're, like, using a snow shovel to scoop up garbage and cups and everyone has left, we all, like, kind of embrace each other, and it's like, oh, my God, we did it. You know, another year in the books. And that was always one of my favorite parts. You know, like, yeah, it's busy, but, oh, it's so worth it. It's so fun.
Yep. I made a lot of good friends through here through the years.
besties.
Yeah.
Gluten free.
You know, we hit it off right off the bat. But then just throughout the years of working the same shifts together, you know, without speaking, without deciding the rules, we just came into this symbiotic dance that we have behind the bar. We know exactly when to move to get out of each other's way. I know by looking at your face what you need, and I can grab it for you. Some people finish each other's sentences. We'll finish each other's drinks, you know, as we're making up.
That story was part of WPR's project, High Tolerance. It's a deep dive into Wisconsin's relationship with alcohol. To hear all the stories, go to WPR.org/alcohol. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
One more time, that's WPR.org/alcohol. You can find all of the stories about the good and bad and the in-between as we examine Wisconsin's complex connection to alcohol in this ongoing series, High Tolerance. Perhaps Wisconsin's most famous alcoholic beverage, and the one we're most known for, is beer. As this week's edition of Wisconsin Weekend continues, we take a look ahead to summer and those special foamy brews that we enjoy during the few months of the year when the air isn't filled with the humming of mosquitoes and the woods are full of deer ticks. Summer doesn't officially begin until June 21st, but, well, why not get a head start on all the beers this season has to offer? From Goza to Hefeweizen, we learn which beers to seek out, where to find them, and how best to enjoy them as the weather warms. But we want to know what your favorite summertime beer is. What is it? How do you like to enjoy beer in the summer? Where do you go? And what breweries are you looking to visit this year? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Tell us your summertime beer stories. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Robin Shepherd is a regional beer writer and senior contributor to the Isthmus. He's written books about beer travels and searching for the perfect pint. He's also an associate professor in the Department of Life Sciences Communication at UW-Madison and a specialist for University of Wisconsin Extension. Robin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, John. It's great to be here.
So what makes for a good summer beer? Is there some official definition, some sort of criteria that needs to be met?
Well, the sun is shining. That's usually a good first step.
Well, the sun shines in January.
That's true.
We're going to have to be more specific.
Well, you know, it's kind of the go-to beer when you think about, you know, drinking alongside a lake, a river, maybe in your backyard, on the patio, watching a baseball game. It's the one that you pull out of the cooler when you're picnicking. You know, summer beers, when we think about them, the trend in what you're looking for on a hot day, a warm day, something that's usually a little lighter, maybe a little lower in alcohol, something that's almost a thirst-quenching type of beverage fits the definition of a great summer beer.
And why do we associate different types of beer with different seasons? And why is summer associated with lighter beers?
Well, it's part of the glorious time to be a beer aficionado is that you have such a great selection of beers in front of you today with the craft beer movement. So if you think about summertime, you're looking, you're reaching for something that's a little lighter, that's a little bit more refreshing. You don't really look for something that's with a lot amount of alcohol because, you know, who wants to, you know, drink a big, bold 8% beer on a sunny day? You just want to crave a nap at that point. Whereas in the winter, you might be looking for a little bit of that warmth. And so we like those richer, sweeter beers in the wintertime with a little bit of an alcoholic warmth to them. In the springtime, we're kind of coming out of those winter doldrums and we're kind of craving a difference in flavor. So it's a spring, just like it is with the growing season. It's a transition time for a lot of beer drinkers. So they're beginning to move from those heavier beers to the lighter beers of summer. So you see interest in things like wonderful Belgian French farmhouse ales, saisons, with their unique yeasty characteristics of spicy and pepperness that still have kind of like one foot in the heavy beer flavor category, but yet this lighter, more effervescent bubbliness that we look for in the summer. And by the time summer's over, you're ready to start looking for the bigger beers of winter, but you're not quite ready to give in to those big, bold, rich, sweet things. So fall is a time for color. The browns, the nut browns, those wonderful beers that have, you know, more gentler malty flavor, even some additions of apples and pumpkins kind of get mixed in the fall because of the harvest season.
Robin Shepherd is a regional beer writer and senior contributor to the Isthmus. He's written books about beer travels and searching for the perfect pint. What's the pinnacle? What's at the very apex of summer beer? Is it Hefeweizen or Goza?
Well, for my taste, I love a good Hefeweizen this time of year. The Hefeweizen is a traditional German wheat beer. About half of its grist or its malt base comes from wheat itself. You know, they date back as one of the oldest styles of beer, but they look cloudy. They are golden and yellow. They are hazy in color because of the wheat and the yeast that's in suspension. And while they look heavy, they're actually quite light and refreshing and bubbly. So really good ones. When you find one, you'll get these wonderful essence of clove and banana, sometimes even a little bit of bubble gum. I'm really excited right now in the southern part of the state. Full Mile Brewery in Sun Prairie is a brewery that just opened up last December, and they have introduced their traditional Bavarian-style Hefeweizen. It's a beer that you can only find there, unfortunately. They don't distribute, but it's on tap right now, and it really fits that wonderful image of drinking one of these great, crisp Hefeweizens in a German beer garden. You see other styles that sort of fit in there. The Belgian Wit is something that's sort of very close. It's a kind of a cousin of the Hefeweizen, only it sort of grew up in the monasteries of Belgium. It's a little on the lighter side. It might be more of a straw color, but it's still often hazy or cloudy. Alcohol on all of these beers, like the Hefeweizen, is usually in that 4 to 6%. Belgian Wits might be a little bit lighter. Both of these beers are wonderful for summertime picnic fare. You know, you envision this of, you know, being on a blanket with some, you know, a little bit of cold fried chicken or a summer lunch sandwich kind of thing. They just
and
are
ants.
Wonderful.
You have to have ants for a picnic.
Yeah, right. There's actually a beer called Picnic Ants, believe it or not.
Of course there is. There's a beer that's called Pretty Much Everything. In fact, I'm sure that that's actually a label. It says Pretty Much Everything or Better Than Nothing. Our Wisconsin Weekend conversation about beer continues in a moment with Robin Shepherd, a regional beer writer and senior contributor to the Isthmus. He's written books about beer travels and searching for the perfect pint. And when we come back, we'll talk about where we could go maybe to for a special brewery experience in Wisconsin, and we want to hear your stories as well at 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. On this week's edition of Wisconsin Weekend, we want to know about your favorite summertime beer. Yeah, I know, summer doesn't officially start until June 21st, but why not get a head start on all the beers this season has to offer, from Goza to Hefeweizen? We're finding out which beers to seek out, where to find them, and how best to enjoy them as the weather warms. So, what is your favorite summertime beer, and where do you like to go to enjoy it? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. We have a caller on from Whitewater. Let's go to Tim first. Tim, good morning.
Yeah, I really have gotten into it. I like the Agosas. I try to keep it in Wisconsin, but there's a nice, really cool brewery over in New Ulm, Minnesota called Shell. And it's a really neat tour if anybody's over in that Mankato area. It's an old brewery, and it's, you know, nothing new and fancy, but they've got a really neat tour, and and buildings to do it at, and they've got a Gosa that's really good. They've also got a, not really thinking about it, a brew called Nor'easter, which is a, was a mistake, I guess. That's kind of a dark light beer, and maybe your guest there knows more about that. But, you know, like I said, I try to keep it in Wisconsin, but I will admit I go over in the Viking land for those sometimes.
Tim, thanks a lot for that. New Ulm, of course, I think they've got two breweries over there. Shell is one of them, but lots of good beer in the upper Midwest. What about the salt component and so forth in Gosa?
Well, Gosa, John, is a very old style of beer that sort of dates back to the eastern side of Germany. Goslar in Leipzig is kind of credited with developing that beer, and the water that they used had a lot of salts in it. So what modern brewers, it's kind of one of those historical styles, really, that has kind of cropped back up on the radar screen. It was pretty obscure until maybe the last 2, 3, 4 years, and the craft beer movement finally kind of picked it up and resurrected it. It probably is a beer that most folks are not acquainted with at all. It does have a little bit of saltiness. When craft beer makers make it, they want it to be sour with a little bit of that salt underneath those flavors. It's commonly a very light beer, probably 4 to 5%. There's a brewery that made one in southern Wisconsin recently, Delta Beer Lab, that made it with coriander and sea salt, and then it also added in some orange juice and grenadine syrup. And then what they did to finish that off is that they fermented it in what are called squarrels. They're square aluminum barrels with oak slats, and the oak slats had been soaked in tequila. So add all of this up, and you get a tequila sunrise Gosa. The beer name was There Gosa the Sun.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Okay, we knew bad puns were going to come into this at some point. Let's. Michelle is with us in Mequon. Next. Michelle, thanks for joining us on the morning show.
You're welcome. And I'm calling just to say that I tried a new beer last summer in the heat of the summer. And it's called, and I'm sorry, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, Schaeferhofer. And it is a grapefruit beer.
Ooh, grapefruit. Well, a lot of summer beers have citrus notes in them, Robin, but what about Schaeferhofer?
Well, the grapefruit infusion into beer is really a wonderful trend right now. We're seeing sort of the Radler craze, which is what she's describing, the Radlers and Shandies. You've probably heard of, you know, Liney's Summer Shandy. And right now, though, I think there's a lot of interest in those infused beers that are part soda, fruit soda, and part beer. So, for example, Wisconsin Brewing Company, which distributes statewide, they just jumped into this game in a big way. They are releasing three different Radlers this summer. The base beer behind it all is a gluten-free, light-bodied Helles Lager. It's a gluten-free beer. So it's all kind of got some light things going on. And then what they're doing is they're mixing that with different types of fruit soda. They're releasing three this summer that are just hitting shelves statewide right now. A cherry lime version, a raspberry lemon version, and a grapefruit version. And these are beers where the soda component is probably more than half compared to the beer. So it's kind of a 60-40 ratio. But the result are these incredibly bubbly, effervescent, very light on the beer side, more of an effervescent, crisp, dry, fruit-flavored soda forward. So you can really see how something like that would appeal on those really hot, warm days. They really are almost like soda water refreshing.
Michelle, thanks so much for your call. 800-642-1234. I think we could sneak a few more calls in before we're done. Robin, what are some of the new breweries that are opening up in Wisconsin this summer that you're excited about? Let's start in Bayfield.
Wow, Bayfield has a lot of stuff going on. Bayfield will have the Adventure Club Brewing that I believe is scheduled to open in a week from now on the 25th of May. It's founded by Matt Gertz, who's a former brewer in Madison at the One Barrel Brewery. He left his position there late last fall and pretty much packed up all his belongings and dedicated everything from the ground up of that little brewery that's going to be in Bayfield. There are other ones that are opening, too, actually in the next few weeks. They're all trying to kind of gear up for the holiday weekend. One Barrel Brewing is opening its new Egg Harbor location up in Door County. The soft opening is actually going on right now. Its grand opening is scheduled for May 23rd through the 27th. Beaver Dam is returning to the brewing craze. They're opening Ooga Brewing, and I believe they brewed their first batch of beer on Wednesday of this week. They're having an open house tomorrow, May 18th. So all of that's sort of coming in line. Madison continues to be growing. Union Corners Brewery on the northeast side should be open within the next week to 10 days. Over in Milwaukee, we're watching, hoping that Dead Bird Brewing will be kicking off a grand opening sometime this summer. It's founded by a couple of young guys that did contract brewing, contract making their beer for about 4 years. I think they started in 2015. They've got a place now that they're going to try to open up this year in Milwaukee. Zambaldi Beer in Eloise is going to open this summer. And Hillsboro Brewing is another one to watch over in Hillsboro. It's been around for a while, but it recently moved to an old historic building, or a building with historic character, I guess I should say. They moved over last summer, but they're about to open up their tap room full steam ahead with a kitchen. And that'll be another reason to visit the Driftless area.
Let's take a call from Chris in Adams. Chris, we're almost out of time. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll do this real fast. I'm allergic to grains, and he was just talking about a gluten-free beer, and I'm always leery when people put that label on things because my body says, uh-uh. So how can you make a beer that is gluten-free when barley has gluten in it and you have to use a malt?
Great question. What brewers are doing is they're substituting something like sorghum or millet or spelt, something that doesn't have that quality. There are a couple of great breweries. What I mentioned, like Wisconsin Brewing, is now just kind of getting into the gluten-free game with their Rattlers. Alt Brew is a small brewery in Madison. That's all they do are gluten-free beers. The wife of the brewery owner has celiac disease, so they are very conscious about it. You know, it's great to inquire when you're interested in a beer. If they are serious about making gluten-free, they will describe the process to you, and they will describe what they're substituting the barley with.
We've got about a minute left here. Robin, you recently wrote about a growing list of Wisconsin communities that are using craft brewing to attract interest in their town and create a sense of community among residents. What towns are trying to do this, and can we find some good summer beer there?
Oh, yeah. This is where a small Wisconsin town has really seen the brewery almost as an anchor tenant to the revitalization effort. So there's oftentimes a historic building involved or pulling back something from their history to have beer part of the draw to that community, like a former brewery. So downtowns like Wanakee have a wonderful brewery there called the Lone Girl Brewing that truly is sort of the anchor to that downtown's revitalization. Ooga Brewing that I mentioned that's opening in the next week or so, it is actually part of a revitalization effort to draw people back into the downtown. Hillsboro was an example of a town that really had seen better days, and that's breathed new life. There's probably no better poster child for a brewery that's really revived a downtown other than Potosi, down on the far southwestern part of the state, a brewery that closed in 72. Local townspeople saw the potential. They raised their own money, over $3 million, to match with other things, and restored that brewery. Now, it's also a brewery in the National Brewery on a Museum.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us, Robin. Robin Shepherd, a regional beer writer and senior contributor to the Isthmus. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show.